TSN 1290, CFRW Winnipeg. Go, Jets, go! Your official home of the Winnipeg Jets. A division of Bell Media.
If you want to know the real deal about the three, we're going to take it with triple chop. We're going to bring you up to speed.
TSN 1290 presents the Illegal Curve Hockey Show with Drew Mandel, Richard Pollock, and Ezra Ginsberg.
Good afternoon, Winnipeg. Good afternoon, Manitoba. And for all those joining us live on TSN1290.ca, good afternoon, universe, and welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. 3 hours of hockey talk ahead for you on this Saturday afternoon here on TSN 1290. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joined in studio by my colleagues Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. Gentlemen, good afternoon and welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
Good afternoon. It's beautiful outside. First off, I'm loving that Timmy is playing Hulkamania right now, Hulk Hogan's theme song. Jordan CCY did a great job. It's UFC madness in Winnipeg. It really is. It's really exciting. I know Remo's going to be there later. I think Remo's actually going to go in the octagon with Rashad Evans.
Yeah, but it should end well.
Apparently Remo's been doing some jujitsu. But it's actually jujitsu spelled J-E-W. So
that's very clever. Well, here, actually, we're going to be down. TSN 1290 is, of course, one of the official sponsors of the UFC Block Party, which is taking place. So I believe Hustler and Jay will hear from them starting in the second hour of the show. They're going to be cutting in with some live on-location reports from the UFC 161 Block Party just outside of MTS Center there later on this afternoon.
And so, Remo's on time, which is great.
Yes, Remus is here on time. So we got a lot in store for you. We got hockey. We got a free agency preview in the NHL. Free agency is going to be here before we know it. We got some more draft preview stuff. We got game two of the cup finals tonight. It's going to be an action-packed, busy day here on TSN 1290 and with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
Well, you know why? Just quickly, I know we want to get to the Stanley Cup finals here, but you know why Remus is on time? It's because Huss is going to be cutting in on our show.
Ah, yes.
And if Huss is involved, he shows up on time for Huss.
That's right.
He shows up on time for Rick, Ralph, and the Roundtable when it's just, you know, us three guys and he's just slumming it with us.
Yeah,
he doesn't need to show up.
That's a very good point you got there, Ezzy. Anyways, we want to hear from you. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. Facebook.com/Illegal Curve is how you can find us on Facebook. And, of course, our website with the latest Stanley Cup final news, Jets news, NHL news in general is www.illegalcurve.com. Gentlemen, game two tonight between the Blackhawks and the Bruins. Blackhawks won the overtime marathon game one, the triple overtime marathon. They lead the series 1-0. Looking back at game one, did you think, in your opinion, that the more deserving team won the game?
Well, I think yes. I mean, if you look at the game as a whole, Boston looked pretty in control in the third period, and then Chicago made the comeback. Johnny Oduya, former Winnipeg Jet, got the goal that bounced off of Andrew Ferentz's skate, but you could see that they were regaining momentum. But, guys, the game went to triple overtime. I mean, it could have gone either way. I don't think you can say one team really dominated the other team, or there were different ebbs and flows of the game, and one team was in control earlier, and I thought the Boston Bruins really kind of fell apart a little bit, and Chicago really started to gain steam, obviously, in the overtime, and were probably the better team in overtime, but this was such a good opening game, and especially with a couple of days off between games one and games two, it was really an impressive game. And considering that they lost Nathan Horton and they didn't have Gregory Campbell in the lineup, I thought the Bruins did a pretty good job on the road there, and they really had the crowd out of it. You remember in the second period there, 21,000 people couldn't have sounded quieter in that arena. I mean, the madhouse was not very mad until the Chicago Blackhawks got back into it, and it was an impressive game. But I thought really that game could have gone either way. When you go to triple overtime, it's tough to look back on it as a whole and say that the Chicago Blackhawks stole one. But they've proven time and time again, well, at least a couple times, I would say, that they can come back from adversity. They faced it against the Detroit Red Wings. They didn't face it a lot in the first round, but this is the Stanley Cup Finals, and, you know, down 3-1, we know what the statistics are. Okay, you can say all you want, Richie, about the statistics, but if you win game one, your chances of winning the cup increase, I think, pretty nicely.
It's been a Chicago's year, guys. I mean, if you think about it, they cruised through the regular season. Yeah.
Whoever picked them to win the cup at the beginning of the year was a smart guy, Drew.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. The opposite of me. And, you know, they cruise through the regular season. They end up, they draw Minnesota in the first round, and they dispatch them quite easily. They play in the second round. They play a Detroit team coming off a seven-game marathon against Anaheim, and they go to the third round. And they obviously played a seven-gamer against Detroit, but then they play L.A., who played a tough series in six against St. Louis, and then seven against San Jose. And they come in here. And the craziest part about Chicago, and they've been just really solid. Corey Crawford's been incredible. No injuries. Like, the team they have there is the team they had at day one. I mean, there's nobody. So it's not like the Gregory Campbell injury and obviously the Nathan Horton injury, which has become a factor. But they don't have an injury, and they're loaded. So it's tough to beat them. In terms of game one, I thought Boston carried the play for the most part, at least scoring chance-wise, in overtime. Dogovins had a great chance. Krejci was the best player on the ice by a mile and a half, as far as I'm concerned. And Chicago got the bounces. I mean, two bounces. Boland, right? Goes off Boland, goes off Shaw, goes in. The Ferentz goal. I think the luck probably was in Chicago's favor. I think the two-day break benefits Boston more than Chicago, because if they had played last night, I think Chicago would have been up 2-0 and probably would have been done. I'm not so sure, even if Chicago wins tonight, that it's absolutely done, but it's a very tight series, and I think going either way, as he's exactly right, these two teams are not necessarily similar, but both extremely good at what they do, and I would not be shocked to see it go the distance, because the quality of play I thought was very good. You could see in the third overtime just how tired the players were. They were exhausted. There was no doubt about it. It was visible. Boston had their chances with the too many men calls.
Mm-hmm.
They hit the post. Char hit the post at the end of a second overtime. Lucic missed the rebound. Jágr had a chance. Dogovins had a crazy open net. Krejci with the chances. I mean, Chicago might have had a couple, but they weren't the quality of Boston, and Boston just couldn't take advantage of it. So it certainly changes the complexion of the series, and it's going to be... I'm really interested to see how the Bruins react tonight, because for Chicago, you know, everything's going their way. And so do the Bruins react and take game two here, or does Chicago take a stranglehold on the series?
Well, you know, after losing game one, I think, you know, given the way they dispatched Pittsburgh and the way they dispatched the Rangers before them, this is sort of the first adversity that Boston has faced in almost the last two rounds. I know that playing Pittsburgh in and of itself has got some adversity, but the way they handled Pittsburgh was so dominant.
Yeah,
do you think they respond in the face of that, or do you think that maybe there's some doubts creeping into their head after blowing two goal leads?
I don't think that this team, even without Gregory Campbell in the lineup, and even without Nathan Horton in the lineup, we don't know if he's going to play tonight. I don't want to say it's 50-50, but... There's a chance, unless something's come out.
It just came
out. Okay, well, there we go. See, that's what we do, Drew. We break news, and we make me look bad.
And we break legs. Literally 2 minutes ago, Nathan Horton, after the game day skate, has come out and said he is playing for game two tonight.
And what is so impressive about that is it's clear that he's got something going on with his shoulder, and he's going to need surgery. It's clear. The guy is probably going to take some painkillers. He wants to be in the lineup. He knows how important this game is, but he's clearly injured. You could tell. They're not going to announce what it is, but with Nathan Horton in the lineup, it helps, of course. But Gregory Campbell completely screws up that fourth line, and you have to bring in, as Richie mentioned, Kasper's Dogovins, and then they had to move up Sagan when Horton was out, but then they have to readjust the lines. But even without Gregory Campbell in the lineup, they still have lots of depth. They could bring in Jordan Caron, or they could bring in Carl Soderberg, who they signed. They have so much depth. I don't think there's any question in this team's mind that they can win the next game tonight and they can win this series. They have so much experience. They've been there so recently. And, you know, a team that beats Pittsburgh in four games is so impressive for so many reasons, because of the fact Pittsburgh loaded up and improved the roster so much. But I don't think that there's any doubt that this team can win. And especially, Richie, it's like you just said. They knew that they were in that game. They were in control of that game, and they could have easily won in overtime. So they know. I mean, you could see these guys after the goal. Rask skates off the ice. All these guys skate off the ice, and they're professionals. They weren't, you know, complaining or, you know, in post-game interviews, they weren't saying that they, you know, should have won the game or whatever. They just know they have to be better. And I think they know one lucky bounce here, that's their game. So when you lose in triple overtime, it would be different if they really got outplayed. Pittsburgh, I think, in the Eastern Conference Finals, they knew that Boston was playing at a higher level than them. I really do believe that. The Pittsburgh Penguins, I'm not saying that I would have picked the Bruins if we went back 2 weeks from now, but I do think the Boston Bruins were playing at a higher level than the Pittsburgh Penguins, and I still think Pittsburgh has more talent, especially, you know, up front with the big boys, Crosby, Malkin, Neal, etc. I just think the Bruins were playing at such a high level. Now they've met a team that's also playing at their highest level, and as Richie said, they're healthy. It's a scary thing when you're healthy.
How did Ray Sherrill win GM of the Year, by the way? What did he do?
He acquired an all-star team that lost in the conference semis.
But like this year, conference finals. This year, what did he do?
I guess he won it on the strength of the Ginla and Morrow trades.
Well, this year...
And Douglas Murray, but I mean, that was a
draft picks for those guys, and Ginla begs his way to Pittsburgh, and then you get GM of the Year. And Ray Sherrill's a good GM, but he's not GM of the Year. Back to Ezzie's point, and we'll
I think, if anything, drafting... Derek Pouliot and Olli Maatta in the first round was, for me, the best thing that Ray Sherrill did, but that has a lot to do with scouts. As far as getting Iggy and Morrow, I mean, a lot of teams could have got Iggy and Morrow, and it didn't actually turn out to do well. So, I don't know. That award's pretty subjective, in my opinion.
And I realize you're basing it on the regular season. But anyways, we'll talk about that later on in the show. I think one thing if you're Boston, a couple of things concern you, but one thing if you're Boston that's very concerning is you blew a 3-1 lead. And
a 2-0 lead.
Right, and you don't play, your game is built on playing from ahead. So there's some concern that if you do get behind today, you have trouble scoring. So we'll see how they react in the face of adversity, Drew. But, I mean, you're talking about a team that was down 4-1 with 10 minutes left or so in the Toronto series in Game 7. This team, adversity, as you mentioned, and as he's exactly right, you know, Claude Julien didn't panic. There's no panic. If this is a young team in their first time at the Stanley Cup Final, I'm very concerned about how they react. I'm not so concerned about them mentally at this point. I think that they're very confident. Who on their team hasn't won a cup? I don't know if anybody hasn't won a cup. I mean Dogovin, sure, but Jágr, who they brought in, he's already won two cups.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Rask won a cup as a backup. There right. isn't too many guys.
So, I mean, everybody essentially now, there's sure like Krug, et cetera, but there's basically nobody on this team hasn't done it before. So you can't panic, and I don't think they will.
Let's go to break. When we come back, more on the Stanley Cup Final Game 2 tonight. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290, TSN1290.ca. This segment of the program is brought to you by our friends at the Certified General Accountants Association of Manitoba. The CGA Association of Manitoba is the largest, fastest-growing, and most diverse accounting body in the province. Did you know that CGAs are among the top 5% of income earners in Canada, with an average yearly salary of $72,000 for new graduates? For more information, contact the CGA Association of Manitoba at cga-manitoba.org. The CGA Association of Manitoba, we see more than numbers. Gentlemen, Game 2 tonight, 7 o'clock puck drop. NHL awards, the remainder of the NHL awards are being handed out starting at 6 o'clock. We'll cover the awards that were handed out yesterday later on in the program.
I like how they're doing that, by the way.
Really? I think it's the stupidest thing I've ever seen.
Really? I like it. You might as well do that. Hey, you don't like the awards anyways.
I don't like an awards ceremony. I think that...
You can have both ways, Drew. I don't mind it. No ceremony.
You can't have your cake and eat it, too.
How about you do it on Thursday? When you can actually get some media, as opposed to doing it Friday at 5 o'clock for the first batch of awards. You got 2 days off for no reason anyways.
The reason why I like it, because it's kind of like the way baseball does it. I like how the way baseball does it. If I'm not mistaken, they do it once a week for a little while, right? They kind of release the Cy Young and all that.
Yeah, but...
I kind of like it just in the sense that the award ceremony, I always liked how Ron McLean did it on CBC. I think he does a good job of doing it, but... You know, release the award slowly. Let's be honest, guys. Someone's going to win the award. The only thing that they're not getting, I don't know if they got an acceptance speech, but I have no problem with that. I mean, you know, give some people to talk about. The fact of the matter is when all the awards come out, you're anyways, it's tough to really ingest it all when you have 12 awards coming at you in an hour anyways. But that's just my opinion. I don't mind it. You know, Paul McLean wins Coach of the Year. Good for him. He deserves it. St. Louis wins the Lady Bing. That's good. The Selke Award goes to Taves. I had no problem with the way they did it this year.
Apparently, Huberto is going to win the Calder because he's in Chicago tonight. Mm-hmm. They flew him. He flew into Chicago, so mm-hmm. people are putting two and two together. That means Huberto's going to win. And the winner of the Hart Trophy isn't going to speak until Sunday morning, which leads people to say it's going to be Ovechkin because he's over in Russia. And rather than having him speak at 4 a.m. Russia time, they're going to have him speak Sunday morning.
What a joke.
I think Crosby should have won it, anyways, to be honest with
we
you.
We can deal with that part. We'll deal with that part later on. Yes. Game two is obviously way more important than these awards.
Did a half-season award this year?
Haven't they heard of Skype?
Well, no, the point is it's 3 in the morning in Russia when they hand out the awards or whatever time.
Ovechkin's up anyways. He's young.
You're going to make an age joke now, Richard?
Well,
go ahead.
No, Remus is up at that time.
Oh, yeah, we know Remus is up at that time. That's definitely the case. Barstar Remus. Game two. Your keys to game two. You know, game one, obviously, these teams hadn't played each other all year. How much can they decipher from game one that'll carry over into game two, or do they know everything about one another just by video already?
Well, I think there are a lot of keys to game two, but if you pick one key, you'd have to think that a good start is one of them. And I know that's, seems pretty fairly obvious, but the further you get in the playoffs, the first goal is important. And the funny thing is, Boston, when they won the Cup against Vancouver, they actually got down 2-0 in that series and ended up coming back and winning that series. But it really is important to get a good start, especially when you're in Chicago and you've given up the lead in game one and all that. But I don't necessarily know that there is anything that the Bruins did specifically wrong or poorly, aside from giving up that lead. I mean, the Bruins played a pretty good game until that third period, and Chicago got those two goals. I believe it was about 3.5 minutes apart there in the third period. But, Rask, most of those goals weren't his fault. And Chicago is going to come at them hard. I mean, they're gonna do what they do the best, and they're going to come with speed, and they're going to try to knock Boston off of their game. And I actually thought a guy that is kind of a controversial figure on the Blackhawks that is kind of the equivalent to Brad Marchand in the Boston Bruins is Andrew Shaw. And I know he got the overtime winner, but Andrew Shaw, if you remember earlier on in that game, was really going at Chara. You're talking about like a 10-inch, 100-pound, 130-pound difference between those two guys. And I really think Chicago is kind of taking a page out of Boston's book in the Pittsburgh series by trying to engage them physically, especially in their own arena. So I want to see that again, and that's important. I really liked how Andrew Shaw's doing that, getting Chara off his game. You know that Chara is going to go up against the top two lines of Chicago anyways. He's going to be on the ice for half of the game if it's a regulation game, or 49 minutes or whatever it was in a triple overtime game. So I do think that Chicago has to engage them physically and continue that. But, I mean, this series, I think, is going to be an absolute war, Richie. I really will not be surprised if we see all one-goal games. A lot of the games go to overtime. I'm not going to be surprised if Boston wins tonight because they were the better team for a good chunk of the game. I don't agree with you as much about the overtime, but I do think that this series is going to be back and forth. I really don't necessarily know you can exploit one weakness of either team. They're just that deep.
Quickly on the awards, do you guys see that?
You're going back to the awards here after I just did a whole spiel on the finals?
Somebody voted Eric Fair for the Selkie?
Yeah, I saw that. He got a third place vote or something.
Were you not even listening to what I was just saying?
I listened to what you said.
No, you're basically saying that was incoherent rambling.
No, it wasn't. I want to touch on...
That was about as coherent as you've ever been.
Thank you. I'm sober right now.
I want to touch on, back to Drew's question, and in terms of...
By the way, I was the one who voted for Eric Fair. Yeah.
Eric Fair for the Selkie, what a joke. Anyhow, when you talk about what adjustments need to be made, I think from Boston's perspective, and Tuukka Rask alluded to this in the post-game press conference, they were trying to be too pretty with their plays, and I thought they had better scoring chances in overtime, but if you think about some of the pass, for example, Krejci was playing really well. They were trying to force some cross-ice passes. Chicago's a good transition team with speed. And Corey Crawford has stopped the puck, but at times, and he's been great in the playoffs, but at times, in overtime especially, he was fighting a little bit in terms of rebounds. Mm-hmm. So the idea would be put the puck on net and go to the net. Put the puck on net low and go to the net for rebounds and such. And I think from Boston's perspective, it's a little bit of the KISS example. Keep it simple, stupid. And I think if they do that, they'll have a better chance of winning tonight.
I'm sure that's the motto of the show is keep it simple, stupid.
That's absolutely right.
Well, there's definitely a stupid in there somewhere.
So I think that, from Boston's perspective, is the key to tonight. In terms of Chicago, I think Chicago can actually play better. And I think, Taves is always going to have trouble because he's going to be up against Chara, but they have so much depth. I think getting speed through the neutral zone is going to be really important, and trying to catch Boston in transition. Boston is a team that likes to play a very structured style, obviously likes to get the lead, and who doesn't like to get the lead? They play a structured style. So if you can take advantage with your defenseman of maybe a guy overcommitting in the offensive zone or in the neutral zone and make a quick pass or use your speed to create some space, I think that's going to be important for Chicago throughout the series, because skating is the key for them, and Boston's more of a size and physical team. So I think those are kind of the two things that I would assume the teams are going to try and focus on, amongst many other things.
Let me ask you guys this question. Last year when the Rangers were in the playoffs, everyone was up in the uproar over how they always collapsed to the net in their own defensive zone to block the shots, right? How much difference is there between what the Bruins are doing largely in their own defensive zone versus what the Rangers were doing last year, and why aren't we as up in arms about it?
Well, guys, to a certain degree, every single hockey team at every level does that, right? But the New York Rangers, and John Tortorella specifically, his system was to do that almost at the expense of offense. It was almost like defense will create offense, and they made a point out of getting every single guy to buy into that, whether it's Brad Richards, whether it's Marian Gaborik, or Ryan McDonagh, one of the master shot blockers in the NHL. So to a certain degree, all teams do that first and foremost. But Boston is an amazing defensive team, Drew. I mean, when we look back at this year, even now, it's been only a week since the Eastern Conference Finals, but the fact that the Boston Bruins kept the highest scoring team in the NHL, the Pittsburgh Penguins, to 2 goals in 4 games is something I don't think we've ever seen before, to be honest with you. I mean, imagine the Edmonton Oilers scoring 2 goals in 4 games against the Boston Bruins or whoever they were playing back when they had the great teams. I mean, I'm not saying the Pittsburgh Penguins of 2013 were the late 80s Oilers or the mid 80s Oilers, but they're a pretty good team, and Boston does it, and they do it really well. But I think the huge difference, I think Richie would agree with this, the difference between the Bruins and the Rangers is they have so many more talented fast forwards than the Rangers do. I'm not saying that the Rangers don't have talent on forward, but when you're talking about guys like Bergeron, and I also think they have better defensive forwards. Sure, the Rangers have Callahan, and they have other guys that are good defensive forward. Even Richards, as he's gotten older in his career, has had to become more of a defensive forward. But I think the Bruins do it almost a little more effortlessly, and it's not a systematic thing like it was for the Rangers. But, Drew, it is a good point. I mean, the Bruins are frustrating to play against. And this is why, Richie said it and I've said it time and time again. 5-on-5, they play so well as a unit, and they're so hard and frustrating to get anything going. I mean, in that Pittsburgh series, going back to the Pittsburgh series again, but we've only had one game in this series. I think Chicago's going to do a better job at it. Pittsburgh had almost no answer for how to generate scoring chances, and it's not just Chara, but Dennis Seidenberg played 48 minutes in game one. He's an underrated defenseman who plays with Chara. Johnny Boychuk, Andrew Ferentz, I think, is an underrated defenseman as well. He's been there for a long time. He was part of that 2011 Cup team. They just know how to play really well. And I think that, sure, they block shots, and some guys block shots more than others, but I think that they do it in a way that's definitely a lot less boring than the way the Rangers did it.
I think a lot of their defense, Vezzi's right. I mean, a lot of they block shots. Most teams block shots, Drew. You watch, lots of the defensive systems are very similar. I think Boston are extremely good at the defensemen covering the posts and defending below the hash marks. But I think when you're talking about really good defensive play, I think Boston's success is very much rooted in not only their system, but their centers and their awareness. And so for that, I'm talking about Bergeron. Yep. I'm talking about Krejci, Kelly, and then, of course, Campbell when healthy. You have 4 very defensively adept centers. And if you want to watch a clinic on how to defend as a center, you watch Patrice Bergeron for a whole game. I can count.
And Krejci, Richie.
Yeah, Krejci too. But 4 hands. How many times Bergeron breaks up dangerous passes by getting into the seam or reading the play and lifting a stick or tipping the puck? He does it better than anyone. Taves is up there as well. They're both terrific at that. And so I think that is really where the strength of their defensive play is. I mean, they'll seal the point, so they'll obviously take away the front of the net first. But overall, their centers are great. And when you look at Rangers centers, Brad Richards, as he's mentioned, is trying to be better defensive. He's never been a very good defensive player. Stepan's a younger player and is learning. and then Brian Boyle comes in and out of Tortorella's doghouse for a period of time, you're not talking about the same level of consistency up the middle. And I think that's the biggest difference.
You mentioned Bergeron. What do you think about Taves over Bergeron for the Selke?
I would have voted for Bergeron, but I think they're both terrific candidates. I think Taves is an awesome player, and I have no issue with that at all.
Yeah, I mean, Taves is a great defensive player. They're forward, specifically. We're talking Selke here. But, you know, you could have given it to either one of those guys. I haven't looked at the vote breakdown. I imagine it was pretty close. But I think one thing is clear. I mean, Bergeron's been better than Taves in the playoffs this year. I think we all agree on that. Bergeron right now is a strong candidate for the Conn Smythe Trophy. Obviously, a lot depends on how this series plays out, but I think he should be, and I think Marchand should be, and I think there's other players that should be. Kane, maybe even Brian Bickle should be Conn Smythe. Mm-hmm. It's not really wide open this year, but back to the way they play, I mean, Patrice Bergeron, and the thing is, that's so important because you know that those guys are going to be all over the ice. These guys are all over the ice, and they really are two-way players in every definition of that term, and a lot of teams don't have that. A lot of times, it's such a luxury to have a guy who's a two-way player. But really, in today's game, you have to have that. I think if you look at all of the teams, and you know, Crosby and Malkin don't get as much credit for it. The fact is, they have the puck on their stick so much, and they're always generating scoring chances. That maybe that defensive aspect of their game isn't utilized as much, and it's not dependent on as much. But I think when you talk about Pittsburgh and Boston in that series, I think that was a way to simplify the game. Bergeron and Krejci outplayed Malkin and Crosby straight up.
Yeah, and you look at the Chicago and the same thing. I mean, we talked about Boston and Chicago. You have Taves, you have Bull, and you have Hanzus, all guys who are really responsible defensively. And Kempley, I mean, Hanzus not as much, but the other two can really play a strong two-way game. So, we've talked about this in the show many times. Strength up the middle. And if you want to put that, you want to, you know, talk about the Jets with respect to that, it's a problem because strength up the middle generally takes you far in the playoffs, and these two teams are a prime example of that.
Let's go to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. If you're out and about in downtown Winnipeg today, remember the UFC block party is taking place. TSN 1290 is the official radio station. Hustler's down there. Jay Richardson's down there. Jordan Sisua is going to be down there, and of course they'll be cutting in the next in the hour 2 and 3. They'll live on location reports from UFC 161.
That block party's not on like my block in River Heights, right?
No, it's not on your block in River Heights.
Okay.
Yeah, but good to, you know, clarify that.
It'd be pretty cool if I went home and there was just like a block party, like Roy Nelson, Rashad Evans, Dan Henderson, all these guys were there. Maybe some UFC girls. There's like some amped energy drink or whatever, some tap out shirts. That would be pretty cool.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks. Thanks for that. Evander Kane, God bless him. Keeps his name in the news, not necessarily for good reasons. You know, at first it was okay, normal day. Evander, he had surgery. You know, clear up that nerve issue that's legitimate. Probably wouldn't be talking much about it today. And then, you know, again, I don't even remember how many months ago it was where I said, why is Evander Kane on Twitter?
That question could be asked, and I believe Matty Leibel and Darren Bomine talked about this either on HNL or at some point. Why should any athlete be on Twitter, really?
Well, sure, what's the benefit of it? And sure, you get to, you know, get close to your fans and everything else. And, you know, he's not wrong about Chris Bosch's play. He just needs to be smarter about what he says.
Well, Chris Bosch's dive cost him $5,000.
Yeah, the dive is, I mean, just, you know, in this day and age, are you telling me he doesn't know what words are appropriate or are inappropriate? You know,
I liked how...
Is he that naive?
I liked how Patrick Burke of You Can Play, who's been on the show before,
mm-hmm.
I like how these guys are listening to Patrick Burke because it's enough already. And you have to know that certain words on Twitter have certain repercussions.
It's not even on Twitter, though. Those words just have repercussions in
right,
everyday society.
Right, but, you know, Evander Kane, you know, when the season isn't going on, even when the season's going on, he shouldn't be he should be accountable for what he says. If a little kid hears him say something that, you know, he shouldn't be saying, listen, Drew, you know, sometimes you're on Twitter, and we were talking about this last week, Evander Kane talking about how he was really sick and tired of not being in the playoffs, and I think we all agreed that we liked that tweet. You know, it was showing that Kane was showing some passion. He was watching the playoffs, and he was already thinking about next year in June. But as far as, you know, comments that have derogatory or, you know, hurtful meanings to certain groups of society, you just shouldn't be saying that stuff. And the fact is, yeah, he apologized, and we're going to forget about this a week from now. But to me at this point, okay, Twitter's been going on, social media, Twitter, Facebook, for the last 5 years, 6 years, whatever. You just see this stuff, and you're like, okay, another, we got to talk about this again. Just it's annoying to me at this point. These guys should know that their Twitter accounts should be used for good intentions. Tweet about, you know, that you're on a family vacation or that
you're
this or that.
Why do I care about any of that?
Well, that's the point.
Why do I care about Evander Kane's Twitter?
That's the point, Richie. The argument is, why are any of these guys on Twitter? It's just going to create controversy where it doesn't have to be.
A lot of the times it's because they want the attention of the tweets, and they like that attention, and then they get addicted to the attention, and that's one of the factors. The tweet was inappropriate.
Does Evander Kane need more attention in the city of Winnipeg? The guy
it's not in Winnipeg. It's everywhere. Right? Well, he gets it from everywhere, and he likes the attention, like many people do. He's not alone in that regard, and I'm making...
Drew loves attention as well.
Yeah, making an assumption that he does. That's one of the reasons he's on, but I think that is the case. And in terms of the tweet, it was an inappropriate tweet. He clearly, overall, doesn't really care what people think of him. I think you can gather that from his overall attitude. Well, I think in some respects that'll serve him well as a National Hockey League player. In other respects, that may be a detriment to him moving forward in his career. But
and I don't mind the fact that he, in some respects, you know, when he sent out the money phone photo, he said, you know, get a sense of humor, guys. And I don't mind that he's not immediately cowers to the backlash.
The timing of that, though, Drew, hold on. The timing of that, though, couldn't have been worse, though. When the players were in the middle of a lockout, complaining that they didn't want their salaries to be rolled back, and then he's flaunting a stack of money, I didn't think that was funny.
It tells you all but he doesn't care, and that's his prerogative. He doesn't have to care about
any... Why does he want people to care about him, then?
Well, because maybe, you know, people are like that. Some people are jerks that really just want to be loved, but they don't know how to go about doing it. I mean, you know, I don't have a problem with him being controversial. I have a problem with him being offensive. And I think there's a fine line between the two, and I don't think he fully understands how to walk that fine line.
I think people are going to start tuning this stuff out.
I think most people do.
He's been here for 2 years, and we've talked about this time and time again on the show. The guy has otherworldly offensive talent as a hockey player, and the sky's the limit for him in the city. He will be a god, if he's not already, with everybody having Kane on their backs. But, I mean, after a certain point, this comment, that comment, this picture, like Richie said, who cares? Like, just, it's enough. Like, you know, just go about your business. And maybe he is. Maybe for him, this is going about his business.
I mean, you're talking about a guy who people deem it to be progress that he's tweeting about how he wants to play in the playoffs. It's like, okay, why is that news? Like, did he not want to play in the playoffs?
It's news because he has 200,000 followers.
Like, is it news that he's tweeting about the basketball game, and then people ask him why he's tweeting about the basketball game? He says, well, I want to be in the playoffs, and next year we're going to make the playoffs. Like, that means, oh, you know what that means? That means absolutely nothing, like most tweets. I mean, I don't know. I mean, what's you know, he said something inappropriate. He backtracked. Do I think that'll actually affect what he says on the ice? No. I don't think it'll have that big of an effect. But He tenders an apology. He aligns himself with Patrick Burke, so maybe it does
in some weird way improve the situation.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. But I think overall, Evander Kane as a person and a player, nothing has changed this weekend. It doesn't change my, you know, my perception of what he is and what he does. You know, he is what he is. He's a talented goal scoring guy that still probably, in my opinion, won't be playing out the remainder of his contract in Winnipeg. I think at some point he'll be gone. And who knows when that'll be or what it'll be. I mean, he's a good player. He's a hard worker. He can score. And the Jets don't have many guys that can score. So, you know, they need him probably more than he needs them right now.
Guys,
but he needs them for the money. And, you know, so be it. This is what you're dealing with. I think one thing I've picked up on over this since he's come here is he's not going to change much. You're not changing him. And if that's the case, you live with him or you get rid of him.
I don't, I mean, I think the fact that he's authentic and he seems to be honest about his personality and everything else is somewhat refreshing. He doesn't speak in platitudes and he doesn't couch his comments in, you know, in cliches. He does seem to be a somewhat authentic person, for better or worse.
I would agree with that. However, a lot of people that you know, and we run into, you know, hockey fans and Jets fans all the time talking about Evander Kane, and a lot of people say, you know what, the guy has a lot of money, he's young, he's just expressing his opinion. Well, that's fine, but when you're rubbing people the wrong way, then, you know, do you care that people are thinking of you in a negative fashion? Maybe not. All we can do, everyone has a different opinion. A lot of people like the cocky, kind of brash, you know, young money, millionaires type of thing.
It was billionaires, but yeah, your point right. is well taken.
Yeah, I listen to Rick Ross, Drew. But the fact is that, you know, you have to be conscious of that. You don't, I mean, and I'm not going to tell Evander Kane what he has to do. He can say, you know, that I'm not listening to anybody. But, you know, he obviously did feel bad about it because he had to apologize after. So my only thing is, Evander, if you're tweeting this stuff, then just don't do it in the first place.
He
just keep it to yourself.
Apologize and tell Patrick Burke messaged him and they talked about it. Otherwise, he said people stop overreacting. So
you're right. The sequence of events was, first of all, he made the comment. Second of all, he told people to stop being so sensitive. And if you don't like it, this is real talk, and I'm going to block you if you don't like it. And then the third step was Patrick Burke contacted him. And then the fourth step was he apologized. Then the fifth step was he met with Kevin Cheveldayoff and Mark Chipman about it yesterday. That's the sequence of events.
Right. And do we need to? Is this necessary? Like, does he want to spend his time doing this? Like, it's to me, it's just creating a headache for him. Like, why not? Why, like, Twitter, Richie got off Twitter because he couldn't handle this stuff. But you have to know that things that you say, the more controversial, if I can say the word properly, or more outspoken you are, the more people are going to respond to you. And then it ends up just becoming, you know, a big fight that goes nowhere.
At the end of the day, why do I care what Evander Kane says about the NBA basketball game? I just don't care. It's like, what does he know about basketball? What do I care what he has to say about basketball?
When we come back on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, we talk about the Edmonton Oilers hiring of Dallas Eakins. You're listening to TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. 10 minutes before the top of the hour, welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. The UFC 161 block party getting underway just near the MTS Center. TSN 1290, the official radio sponsor of the block party. Head down there, say hi to Jay, say hi to Hustler, and of course you can enter to win lower bowl UFC tickets for tonight if you don't have your hands on any yet. Head down to the block party, you can enter to win UFC 161 tickets.
I don't know why you're throwing it to me here. You had something brewing here, so just, you know.
I thought you did too, so. No. Are you a deadhead, Drew?
Am I a deadhead? Yeah. Not particularly. Did you think I was?
Yeah, I can see you being a deadhead. You and Bill Walton driving around the U.S. catching concerts.
Yeah, that's nice. Edmonton Oilers hired a new head coach. Guy familiar to people in Winnipeg with his time with the Moose and the Jets, Dallas Eakins. By the way, when did it become Eakins? I thought it was Eakins for years.
I noticed that as well on TSN. All the insiders were calling him Eakins. Maybe it's been Eakins the whole time.
Possibly. Anyways,
I remember the Eakins diet that Richie was on. So.
Dallas Eakins hired as the new head coach of the Edmonton Oilers. Obviously, he was the hot coaching candidate this offseason after the work he's done with the Toronto Marlies. First question, I mean, you know, how much of a raw deal did Ralph Kruger get in his one, you know, abbreviated season as Oilers head coach?
I'd say about as raw of a deal as you can get as an NHL head coach. You get 48 games. That's not a lot. You get a short training camp, and you're immediately removed from your position, and who knows where you're removed from your position on Skype, no less.
You get fired by Skype when you're over in Switzerland or wherever he was.
After having spent some time with Craig McTavish at the World Championships, I think it was a pretty harsh decision. Luckily for him, he gets paid, but I do think that... for a guy for his first head coaching position on a team that has a lot of skill but doesn't have a lot on defense, you can put question marks in goal and certainly isn't very big up front. I don't think it was really fair. But as Craig McTavish said, you're not in the business of being fair, and he had to do what he thought was right. So a lot of times when you see a change in management, people want to bring in their own guy. And I think well, Kevin Lowe, and obviously had Tambellini there, and then Kevin Lowe brings in McTavish. It's kind of similar to Jim Nill and going to Dallas and getting rid of Glenn Gallitzin and just wanting to bring in his own guy. So I understand it from that perspective, but it also is unfair. It's both.
Wasn't Ralph Kruger hired? When he was hired a year ago, wasn't one of the part of the thing they said is how good he is with young players
yes.
and how good he is at developing young players? And the thing they said when Dallas Eakins was hired is, you know, how good he is with young players. And, you know, do you think there's a possibility these teams just get so infatuated mm-hmm. with being the team that hires the next hot coaching prospect that they lose, you know, they don't see the forest through the trees?
Drew, you've got a bit of a point here.
Only a bit. But, there you go.
No, okay, you've got a whole point.
Thank you.
But Dallas Eakins has been the next NHL head coach to be for almost 3 years now. I mean, the guy did a great job with Nazem Kadri, and we all know what he's done with, you know, Fratton and Gardner and all these guys in the Toronto Marlies system. For those who don't know, Eakins was the head coach of the Toronto Marlies, the Leafs AHL affiliate. And the Toronto Maple Leafs really, you know, reaped the rewards of that this year, made the playoffs, and a lot of these guys became staples. And there's other guys too, Mike Koska and other depth players for the Toronto Maple Leafs. And so in that sense, Richie, he's been the heir apparent for an NHL head coaching job for a while. We know the Vancouver Canucks interviewed him, and there was a lot of speculation that they were going to hire him, but now it looks like they've interviewed Tortorella, they've interviewed other guys, maybe Lindy Ruff as well. But it's back to Ralph Kruger for a second. Yes, he has a reputation in Europe of developing players, and he's got a style that's almost kind of new era, a different type of head coaching style, a bit of a throwback from, say, a guy like Pat Quinn or a guy like that. And, you know, 48 games is nothing. And to Richie's point, at least Mac T admitted, you know, that it kind of sucks that he had to fire Kruger. Dallas Eakins is the guy they wanted in there. At least he admitted that. That doesn't make it any better. You can bet that Ralph Kruger, this is his first NHL head coaching job. I mean, it might be his last. Mm-hmm. You never know. I mean, there's a lot of guys that have had one NHL head coaching job, and then they never get one again. I mean, the list is endless here. It's not like these guys have, on average, 25-year NHL coaching careers. But as we were talking about off-air, Richie, Dallas Eakins, I think, got the best head coaching gig you could possibly get, with the exception of maybe the Colorado Avalanche, as far as head coaching gigs go with, you know, Patrick Waugh there. I mean, you've got so much talent there.
In Edmonton.
You're going to lose Ryan Whitney probably to UFA. We're going to get into that a little bit later. You got to get a few more defensemen in there. But the forward talent that they have, even if they decide to trade a Hemsky or a Horkoff with Nugent Hopkins and Yakupov and Eberle and Gagne, the list goes on and on and on. You know, he's in a good situation. And, you know, I like the move, but I don't like the move in the sense that Kruger basically gets pushed aside. Okay, thanks for, you know, your 48-game season here. But Eakins is our guy. It does leave a bit of a foul taste in your mouth, but at the end of the day, these coaches are hired to be fired. And it's a cliche, but they really are.
Organizational vision for the Oilers has been just to be terrible, probably somewhat intentionally and somewhat unintentionally, and to not have any form of a game plan. So now you're thinking maybe McTavish comes in and has a game plan. It's a sweet job. He gets to bring in Dallas Eakins and now the question is, you know, he's made proclamations that he really wants to probably get rid of Horkoff and Hemsky.
Yeah. I never understand why you proclaim that publicly.
Yeah, but I mean, there'll be interest in both of those guys. I mean, Horkoff's a responsible two-way player. I mean, his contract's significantly a significant overpay, but as a character guy and near the end of his contract, he'll be something. Some team will have interest in him. Hemsky as well. I mean, you know, I think a year left on his deal, and he can add offense, and he's a good passer. Well, he's generally injured, but the Oilers need to improve their defense, need to get bigger, and they need to figure out questions in goal. And Craig McTavish comes in there, and he's probably going to make a heck of a lot of moves. And at the end of the day,
doesn't he have to, Richie? I mean, last year they took a step backwards. I think he has to make some moves.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're bad for that long. You get another high draft pick. So, I mean, the Oilers aren't exactly put it this way. The Oilers aren't the Detroit Red Wings here. That's not a smooth operation. They've changed visions 100 times, whether it be Pat Quinn, whether it be Tom Rennie, whether it be Ralph Kruger, whether it be Tambellini, and now with Craig McTavish and Kevin Lowe, what's he doing? What's his role? And they're angling for the new arena and trying to pressure the mayor of
City Council.
Yeah, the mayor of Edmonton, Drew's cousin, Not actually Drew Scott.
No, his last name is Mandel,
yeah.
though.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, all those things, the optics aren't great, and yet their fans are going to pay, and they're going to see a ton of talented players. But you can't just suck for that long and just automatically become good without a little bit of an organizational vision. And the question is, what's it going to be for McTavish here on out? But from Kruger's perspective, it doesn't sit right. You didn't come in immediately and get rid of him. You sat with him, you said, and also, right. let's also take into account this, guys, and we don't want to overlook this fact. Glenn Healy said in the Hot Stove, it was the last week or week, last Saturday, that the Oilers offered the associate head coaching position to Rick Bowness. He said no and went to Tampa.
Yeah, that's when you have Buckberger there.
But no, the question is, if you offered the associate position to Rick Bowness, then you are happy enough with Kruger as your coach. Then they interviewed Dallas Aikens for the associate coaching position, which never made sense because he was interviewing for all the head coaching positions. And then you got rid of Kruger. So even in that case, if that's accurate, we don't know. That we're assuming that's accurate. And if it is, where's the vision there? You clearly didn't have the idea to do that until you interviewed Aiken. So was he that good in the interview? And I want to caution, because if you remember back many years ago, 10 years ago about now, Brian Trotsche goes into the Rangers interview, blows them away. He's got two binders full of information and blows Glenn Sather away. I don't know if he lasted 40 games. I'm not, and people say about Dallas Aikens that he's very accomplished and he's well-respected and he's very impressive, and I don't doubt that. I'm just saying this wasn't something that was part of the plan 3 weeks ago. It seems like the plan changes all the time in Edmonton.
Which goes back to your point about right. there not being a vision for the organization.
And there's also the belief that wherever Alain Vigneault goes, Rick Bowness will go.
Well, he's already in Tampa.
Rick Bowness has already been hired in Tampa, yeah.
That's true. Sorry.
And Vigneault, apparently, as of this morning, is looking like the favorite for the Rangers position.
Right, and we'll deal with that hiring or potential hiring a little bit later on in the program. You know, I just go back to, my point is, you know, who was the last great big hotshot head coach?
Who, that, Boucher?
Guy Boucher.
How long did
Guy Boucher last?
Yeah.
You know? And he had a great year. He had a great first year. But all of the bloom came off the rose pretty quickly there. You know, these guys are only geniuses for so long. And
but you can only but the Aikens, you can only go up. This team hasn't made the playoffs in 34 years.
So Ralph Kruger, give Ralph Kruger another right. year. Give him a full year and a full training camp.
You're putting him in position, Drew, essentially not to fail. I mean, that's the thing with Aikens. You're hiring him and he can't do any worse. And he's going to make the playoffs in the next little bit here. And they take some trades and trade some of the young players or a young player for two really good players. Or you trade Gagne. Or you sign the defenseman, although the defenseman market's not great. Or you do some of that stuff. You're eventually going to sneak into the playoffs. And then you could... really move. We could really have some great
success. I understand the hiring. I understand why you take the job if you're Dallas Aikens, because you got, like you said, you got nowhere to go but up.
Yeah, and you got all this young talent.
And you got all this young talent. I just don't understand the logic or you know why Dallas Aikens is that much better than Ralph Kruger from an Oilers perspective.
Drew, you make a good point. I think Richie, when he talks about organizational philosophy and direction, when you keep firing your coach every 2 years and throwing your coach under the bus, not anyone individually. First off, Guy Boucher, I'm a huge fan of, and I mean, Guy Boucher, did he inherit the bad goaltending? Was that his fault? Stamkos and St. Louis and Purcell and all these forwards, they seemed to do pretty well under Guy Boucher, but the team didn't do well, didn't make the playoffs, so he becomes the guy that they fire. That's fine. Stevie Y made that decision. I still think he could have done a good job there. I have a problem when these coaches just get fired under circumstances that are not necessarily their own making. And I think that Oilers have gone through so many coaches. Like, what's going to happen if the Oilers don't make the playoffs this year? Are they going to fire Aikens?
He's not as much of a genius then if he doesn't pull it off, right?
At a certain point, you have to stick with a guy for a while and see what he does. Don't just give him 1 year.
Whatever, guys. Kevin Lowe won 6 cups.
Let's go to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290.
There's a story all about how my life got flipped, turned upside
1 hour down,
down
2 hours like to go. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And our website is www.illegalcurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show hotline.
We welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, the original guy from West Philadelphia, our good friend, Anthony Sanfilippo. Anthony, good afternoon, buddy. How you doing?
You know what? You guys finally nailed it. No more Elton John. No more Rocky theme. That's right. West Philadelphia born and raised. This guy right here on the phone with you, and I'm really happy to be back with you guys. It's been too long.
Absolutely. Well, normally we'd have you on because the Flash would be making a long playoff run, but that wasn't happening this year.
No, not at all. I've been spending the last 2 months in hiding under a rock somewhere. So it's good to be able to come out for once and see the sun.
Anthony, the Flyers made a splash this week. They acquired Mark Streit, or the rights to Mark Streit, from the New York Islanders in exchange for a prospect and a fourth-round pick. First question, you know, is Mark Streit the answer or just part of the answer for the Flyers' defense woes?
I believe it's going to be part of the answer, guys. I think that the Flyers are going to look to overhaul that blue line a little bit. I think Mark Streit is the first move. I think there's going to be another one, whether it's through trade or free agency. We'll see. I tend to think it's going to come through a trade of some kind because the free agency crop is not all that exciting. But I think that you're looking at adding Streit, and when you now look at it, say, well, now they have like 8 healthy defensemen. What are they going to do? I wouldn't be surprised to see one of their 28-year-old defensemen, whether it's Braden Coburn or Andre Mizaros, get shipped out of town and try and get something in return for them.
Anthony, you look at this team, they're right now actually over the salary cap, and Mark Streit, to be able to re-sign him, essentially they have to wait until the buyout period, because if they give him the money that he's asking for, they actually may exceed the 10% limit of going over the cap.
Right.
Are they looking, the people we keep hearing about are Ilya Bryzgalov and Daniel Briere. I don't believe they've used any buyouts yet, so are they considering buying out both of those guys? And if so, do you think both of them will be bought out, or do you think it'll be one or the other?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yes, they've talked about both, and it's likely that both will happen in some capacity. Whether they're both bought out remains to be seen. I know that they would like to hold on to the one compliance buyout for the possibility of needing it next year. So they're really, really hoping that Danny Briere would be willing to waive his no-trade clause so that they could move him somewhere else. Because to be honest with you, people say, well, why would you want to trade for Danny Briere? He's got a $6.5 million cap hit, and, you know, he's not worth that money. This is true, but a lot of teams operate close to the floor with the salary cap. So you get Briere's cap hit, it pulls you up, but they only owe him $3 million for this coming season and $2 million for next season. So if you find a team that has that room and would take on a veteran player and say, you know, that'll help us, it would make sense. But Briere's situation is such that he went through a divorce. He's got 50-50 custody of his children. They live in New Jersey. They go to school in New Jersey, right near there, across the bridge from Philly. So he kind of wants to stay close by. So I think he's going to determine if the Flyers can make a deal where he could keep him nearby, New Jersey, New York, Washington kind of thing, then I think maybe Danny will accept it, and then they'll use the buyout on Bryzgalov. If not, they're probably just going to have to use the buyout on Briere and then make a decision on what to do with Bryzgalov. And that's where it's a tough call at this point, because I'm not convinced everybody in the front office is on board with using both buyouts this summer.
Anthony, if the Philadelphia Flyers do decide to buy out Ilya Bryzgalov, what's the solution in net? Who do they go after? Do they try to build within, or do they go after someone else in the free agency market?
Yeah, I think that the best, what I keep hearing as a possibility is if they, and again, this is if they buy out Bryzgalov, they would try and I know they've coveted Jonathan Bernier from L.A. for the last 3 seasons, and the Kings have just held on to him. Well, now it's pretty evident that Jonathan Quick is an elite goalie in the league, and they know that Bernier has value and can get them something in return. I wouldn't be surprised if they buy out Bryzgalov if they don't try and put together a package deal. Could include Matt Reed to go to L.A. and bring Bernier in to tag team with Steve Mason as your pair for next season.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. We're joined by Anthony Sanfilippo, who covers the Philadelphia Flyers for PhiladelphiaFlyers.com. Anthony, you just mentioned Matt Reed. You know, is he the main trade chip that the Flyers are going to dangle this offseason, or are there other guys they'd consider parting with, like Couturier, for example?
I don't think Couturier is going to go. I know so many people have talked about him as a possibility, but, you know, he's a guy that while he struggled in his second season, I think that the Flyers still look at him as an elite two-way forward down the road. And they don't grow on trees. I mean, you got a handful of them in the league. You know, you're watching two of the best in Taves and Bergeron in the Stanley Cup Finals right now. They feel that Couturier could be that kind of player. If, in fact, that's the case, they're going to hold on to him. But I'm not convinced that they're going to hold on to Braden Schenn. I think that if the right deal comes along where they can get a number one caliber defenseman in a trade, and Braden Schenn has to be part of the trade, I think that will happen. So I don't think there's money more than other than maybe Luke Schenn and Claude Giroux and Couturier. I don't see many guys who are untouchable on this team. So I wouldn't be surprised if there's a little bit of a makeover and you see a whole new Flyers team come training camp in September.
There's some talk in Winnipeg, Anthony, from Jets' perspective for a second, that you know Dustin Byfuglien may be a guy who's on the market, and Philadelphia has holes on defense. Do you see a fit at all there for a possible? Is that something that Philly may be interested in?
I sent an email, and this is a true story. I sent an email at the end of the season to a high-ranking executive with the Flyers that asked about Dustin Byfuglien, and his response to me was, "He's bigger than you." Now, you guys know, you hung out with me, I'm not the smallest guy in the world. So if I'm big and I'm a little overweight, what does that say about Dustin Byfuglien? So I don't think that's the kind of guy that they're looking for. I think that they're going to go to try somewhere else in that regard.
That's a good story right there, Anthony. And the draft is upcoming. We'll actually be at the draft. We're looking forward to that in just about two weeks' time. So if you're down there,
Yeah.
If you're down there, we'll go out. We'll have some good times. We'll make sure Ezzy's well behaved.
It's got to be at the restaurant that has the most trans fats, though.
And there's plenty. Believe me when I tell you guys, there's plenty of that in Newark.
Which we're looking forward to. And the Flyers in Newark are selecting 11th. Anthony, do you see them using that pick? And because I know they've kind of, you know, depleted their system to get good young players, but they don't have much in the system right now. Do you see them using that pick to make a deal, either combining with another player on the roster or to make a deal for a player who can help them now?
You know, it's interesting that you asked me that because I just had a conversation with somebody from the team about that very topic. And, you know, they give you the company line. Yeah, we like, you know, we think it's a deep draft. We like the players that are in this draft. We think we can get a very good player at number 11, and you know, the names that were kind of thrown at me were Nikita Zadorov, the defenseman from London, or Sam Morin, another big body defenseman. But I'll tell you right now that there are some scouts with the Flyers who are really high on Valeri Nichushkin, and he's looking to go probably in the 5 or 6 spot. They believe that he might be NHL ready at 18. And they don't be surprised to see the Flyers try to maybe combine the first round pick at 11 and maybe a player like Coburn to a team to jump up if they feel that they can get Nichushkin there. I think that's something that they'll consider to do if it's made available to them.
Anthony, we have to talk to you about Claude Giroux because it came out yesterday that the Philadelphia Flyers and Claude Giroux's camp have started to negotiate, and we saw the contract that was given to Evgeny Malkin by the Pittsburgh Penguins earlier this week, the 8-year deal. Do you think that the Flyers and Giroux's camp are using that contract, as a benchmark for their negotiations, or do you think this is kind of completely separate to Malkin's negotiations and contract that he was awarded with Pittsburgh?
Yeah, I think it's easy to say that would be a good benchmark, but I don't think that's what we're looking at. I think that the Flyers have always, with young stars, while they may give them longer term so that they can guarantee them more money, they tend to bring the dollar value down a little bit with the salary cap. That's kind of how they operate. So I wouldn't be surprised to see Giroux sign for like 7-6 years and probably somewhere in the neighborhood of a cap hit that would be, you know, 6 to 6.5, and therefore he's going to get, but they'll give him a lot of it up front, so he'll make some big money early, and then it'll decrease as time goes on. So, I think that he's going to get paid, he's going to get his money, and he's going to be with this team for a long time. I know that it's funny to say that because every other young captain that they brought in here or young star that they brought in, they seem to have traded them away. But I think that they really believe in Giroux, and they think that he's one of the top 10 players in the game, and they're gonna ride him as their superstar moving forward.
Anthony, we'll let you go on this last question. He's a guy who's sort of always in the background of the Flyers now since his concussion issues. Any development at all, any news at all regarding the progress of Chris Pronger?
Yeah, I wouldn't expect much of anything, guys, with Pronger. He's not officially retiring, and I think that he's saying that just so the Flyers can continue to put him on LTIR because he's a 35-plus contract and not have to get stuck with that cap hit every year. So he's going to continue to say that he's trying. However, the last time we all spoke publicly with him, he handed us a letter from a doctor in Pittsburgh, concussion doctors in Pittsburgh, who advised him to never play hockey again. So I can't imagine that he's ever going to try to play again. But I, at the same time, it is Chris Pronger. I will never say never, knowing Chris as well as I do. But I wouldn't anticipate that he's on the ice at all within the next year.
Anthony Sanfilippo covers the Philadelphia Flyers for PhiladelphiaFlyers.com, and he's a little-known softball expert. How's the softball tournament going, Anthony?
You know, it did not go very well, boys. We lost in two ugly games really, really quickly. So lick our wounds and get back out there tomorrow afternoon.
And you'll have to adjourn to the beer tent for the meantime.
Yeah, well, that's why we're here. We're back at our sponsor, and we're going to have a few pops and drown them in our sorrows. So.
Anthony Sanfilippo, thanks as always. We'll see you in New Jersey for the draft.
Sounds good, boys. See you then.
Take care. Big thank you to Anthony Sanfilippo from PhiladelphiaFlyers.com for having just joined us here on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. In case you missed it, we'll make it available both on the website and on tsn1290.ca. We'll probably throw it on iTunes, so no excuses for not finding that quality interview and the entire show wherever you're going to look for it.
Do you think Anthony's ready for us to be, like,
no,
on his home turf now? Like, he's been to Winnipeg.
Yeah.
We've gone out with him.
Yeah.
He's been on our show. For those who don't listen to our show, he's probably been on our show more than any other guest.
If they're not listening to our show, how are they going to hear that?
No, I meant to say, like, if you haven't listened to our show in previous years, or you're a regular listener, you know what, Drew? You can't just, every little mistake, you have to nitpick it and point it out. You can't just let me.
No. On this show, we drive the bus over one another. You've been on the show for 4 years now. You know that better than anyone else.
That's true. We do like to run the bus over each other.
Exactly. We're going to talk for the next 45 minutes to an hour about the free agent defensemen and goaltenders in the NHL. Next week, we're going to focus on the free agent forwards. Before you know it, I mean, NHL Free Agency Day starts is July the 5th, which is a Friday. So, I mean, it's only about 3 weeks away, and between that and the NHL draft coming up at the end of the month, there's no time to do it besides right now. So we're going to spend the rest of the next, you know, like I said, 45 or so minutes talking about the NHL free agent defenseman. You look at the Winnipeg Jets organization, and as much hate and dislike as there is for Ron Hainsey, and, you know, by all accounts, he's going to test the market, and it's at best a questionable possibility of him returning to the Jets at best. There's a lot of minutes the Jets need to fill on that left side defensive role. You know, you look at the unrestricted free agent defenseman and you look at the Jets roster themselves. Do they have anybody, you know, within the roster right now that can fill the role that Ron Hainsey played last year for the Jets?
No, I don't think so. And I think the Jets need to secure a top four left side guy, whether it be via free agency or trade, and we're going to break down all the free agent possibilities, you know, in the next hour. But the Jets need to secure that top, need to fill in that top four, and they need to be able to add somebody to the Bufflin, Enstrom, Bogosian. Whether somebody's traded, maybe Trouba sneaks in. You got Redmond, you got those guys, but there's Klitsam. If they want to re-sign him, he's a free agent. But I mean, they need a top four guy. I don't think Klitsam, he played well for periods, but he's probably a 5-6 guy with Stewart and the like. So they need to add a top four guy, and they need him to be able to play, likely need him to be able to play the left side.
Yeah, and let's get this, you know, out there right off the bat. And this applies to free agent defensemen. This applies to maybe not so much free agent goalies, but it applies to defensemen and forwards. This year's free agent market is horrible. Adam Proto of the Hockey News wrote about it. We've had him on Illegal Curve before. He wrote about it. I mean, this is a bad year. And when you're talking about defensemen, I mean, Gary Lawless wrote about it earlier this week, I believe, if it wasn't last week, about Ron Hainsey and how he was unlikely to sign with the Jets. I mean, That's no secret. That's no surprise. For a guy making that much money, sure, he led the NHL in block shots, and he played a shutdown role for the Jets, and he did a good job. And I, in fact, argued before the trade deadline the Jets should keep him during the playoff run. Richie disagreed with me, and that's fine. But when your top defenseman available in the free agent market are a guy like Ron Hainsey or Marek Zidlicky or Roman Hamrlik, I mean, these are guys that are all past their prime. When I look at the free agent market, you know, a guy that stands out for me as far as a guy who I think would really work for the Jets or a guy that I like is a guy like Andrew Ferentz. The Bruins might re-sign him, but you're looking at a lot of guys between the ages of 28 and 37, or 38 even. In some cases, Hamrlik, you know, is, I believe, almost 40. It's a bad free agency market. And, you know, as far as the Jets go, they're going to lose Hainsey, Richie, and Trouba will play in the NHL next year. It's not a question. He's under contract. But a guy like Trouba, you're not going to put him right into the top four. Mm-hmm. You're ideally going to play him in a bottom pairing situation like a Dougie Hamilton, right? So Jacob Trouba isn't going to step right into, a number two pairing. Maybe he will at certain points in the season, but you're not, you know, if you're Claude Noel, you're not penciling him in as, you know, your shutdown defenseman. This is a guy who's never played a single game in the NHL. So the Jets, as far as defense goes, will definitely have to address that. And I think that they need a bigger physical defenseman. You know, Rob Scuderi is a guy who will be available as a UFA. He was injured this year for the LA Kings, but a guy like that. But, you know, that's a big question mark here, because when the Jets don't have a guy like Bogosian in the lineup, they really struggle on defense. They really do, because they don't have a lot of depth. And you're talking about putting in rookies. Last year, they had to put in Paul Postma and Klitsam and other guys that probably they would have not liked to have put in that much. And you have to factor in, just quickly, Zach Redmond will be healthy, so he's going to be a mainstay. So he's a guy that will probably play more games next year. But it's absolutely a huge issue that the Jets have to address, Drew.
I don't necessarily agree with you that Zach Redmond is going to be a mainstay with the Jets or going to play a lot of games last year. Again, I remind, you know, people keep talking to me about Zach Redmond. Zach Redmond had a great story the way he was able to come back. But you got to remember, the reason why that injury happened is because he was a healthy scratch that game. So if he's a healthy scratch, I should tell you something about the skill set of Zach Redmond. He's not a top four NHL defenseman. Last year, Ron Hainsey played...
He might not be now, but I don't agree with that he doesn't have that potential.
He might have the potential down the road, but I don't think you can pencil him in for next year to be a top four.
I didn't say you could pencil him in. I said he would be a mainstay.
Okay, that's fair. You did say mainstay. But Ron Hainsey played 22 minutes and 51 seconds per game last year for the Winnipeg Jets. Looking at the unrestricted free agent defenseman, is there anybody out there who can come in, you know, Ron Hainsey aside, really, and you know, fill up those minutes for the Winnipeg Jets?
Yeah, there are guys who can do it. I mean, not going to...
Guys that you want to do it?
Well, did you want Hainsey to do it?
Probably not.
So, I mean, I like Eddie's suggestion on Ferentz. I think that's exactly what kind of guy they need. And Andrew Ferentz isn't a big guy, but he skates well, and makes a pass, can move the puck, solid. Just a really solid, dependable guy. And I like his game. The Bruins have about $5 to $6 million in cap room. What do they do with Jagr? What do they do with Horton? They need to get a backup goalie. So there could be a possibility of a push there for Ferentz on his big on a last big deal kind of thing.
Well, let's talk about Andrew Ferentz. He's coming off of a 3-year, $6.75 million contract.
Drew.
His cap hit was $2.25 million. Yeah. So he slots in your opinion, he slots in nicely as your second pairing left side defenseman?
For the Jets, yeah. Oh, for sure.
I mean, if he is for the Boston Bruins, he definitely is for the Jets.
So what's he going to take to get Andrew Ferentz? What kind of contract do you see, you know, him demanding on the open market?
Ferentz is 34 years old, right? So, right. I mean, you're looking at probably for a guy like that, you're looking at, just off the top of my head, 3 years, 3.5 a year kind of thing probably, just by the way he's... You know, and he's played 5-6 role for the Bruins. He can play a 3-4 role for the Bruins, and he's very dependable. And, you know, a guy who was part of the Calgary team, I believe, went to the Cup in 2004. That's almost 10 years ago now, mind you. But a guy who's good, who is... You can rely on him to just be solid. And I think that's exactly what the Jets need, is this veteran. They need a veteran. I think a guy who can solid defensively, can take away angles. Just watch the way he plays. He plays really, really smart game. So I think he'd be a nice fit.
Yeah, and if you're talking about the free agency market, the high end guys, and Drew, leading up to the July 5 trade deadline, free agency period, free agent frenzy. I wouldn't call it a frenzy this year, mm-hmm. but if you're talking about guys that are going to get a lot of attention, Zidlicky on the Devils, who I think has taken a step back, and Whitney, who's more of an offensive defenseman. He was a healthy scratch for the Edmonton Oilers. Leopold, Ian White. I mean, the guys that you want are veteran guys because you have Bogo and you have Trouba and you have Enstrom and even Byfuglien. The Jets have a plethora of offensive-minded defensemen.
Right.
So you don't need a Ryan Whitney or a Marek Zidlicky, yeah, right?
That's right.
I think we'd all agree with that. Yeah. You need a guy in there, even a Douglas Murray. But the problem is, you know, do you want to give those guys $3 or $4 million a year? Ferentz, I think, is worth it. Douglas Murray, I'm not so sure if he's worth that much money. But this year, if you think Ron Hainsey was paid 4 years ago, remember, Ron Hainsey himself admitted the reason why he got so much money was because the Thrashers wanted Brian Campbell. And Brian Campbell was overpaid, and then the market was set, so Hainsey comes in there. Now all of a sudden paying Hainsey $4.5 million when Campbell's getting, what did he get, $6 million or $6.5, whatever. So you're going to see guys get overpaid. But Mark Streit, now he was acquired by the Flyers, right? Now you're going to see all of a sudden he was the top guy. Now what's left? Now you're getting down to offensive-minded guys that are probably past their prime, or it's debatable whether they're worth that money. So the Jets are going to have to decide, do they want to throw out a little bit more money for a guy that's basically a defensive forward? Pardon me, defenseman. I think they should.
Campbell's making 7-1, yeah. So
let's go to break. When we come back on the other side, I want to talk about individual free agent defensemen who are out there and what they, you know, how they would fit in with the Jets, and if they would, and what kind of amount of money they'd be looking for on the market. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're talking unrestricted free agent defensemen and how they would fit in with your Winnipeg Jets, live on TSN 1290.